From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how reform to Wisconsin's expungement law could make the difference for jobless people in the Milwaukee area.
It's a very big issue among unemployed people. And at a time when unemployment is so low, it's down to around 3%, we're looking for ways to reduce barriers that exist.
Plus, we'll learn about the lesser-known aspects of criminal sentencing, known as collateral consequences.
Author David McGlynn reflects on the realities of being a father in his latest memoir.
And our film contributor talks about what makes French films distinctive.
I think that there is a tendency toward intelligence, that French films tend to be, you know, a bit smarter maybe than, in some way, than many Hollywood films.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We've reported extensively on the issue of mass incarceration and how it impacts the Milwaukee area. But the criminal records of more than a million Wisconsinites impact their lives long after they've served their sentences. Having a conviction prevents many people from being able to get a job.
But the legal expungement of a criminal record could make a significant difference in employability for many Wisconsinites. So why isn't it used more often? The Wisconsin Policy Forum explored how expungement works in this state and how Wisconsin's use of it differs from other states around the country. Senior researcher Joe Pietrangelo joined us recently to share what he learned. He explains what we're talking about when we use the term expungement.
Expungement is the ability to clear a criminal record or to seal it from public access without a court order. So it's a way to be able to move on from a past criminal conviction.
It doesn't mean that the conviction never existed, though.
Right. It's sort of treated as if it never happened when it's expunged. The file still exists, but it is not allowed for public access. And also that applies to the web, because now a lot of the court records are accessed on the web.
Well, and so what sorts of cases are eligible for expungement typically?
So in Wisconsin, it is lower level crime. So it started off, it was only misdemeanors. It did expand in 2009 to include low level nonviolent felonies. It's limited in its scope.
One of the issues, though, that comes up in this report is non-convictions, dismissed charges, and acquittals. Why are those part of a criminal case record at all?
It's a good question. It's always been that way in Wisconsin, that the case is still recorded and there's still access to it even online if the case was dismissed or ended up in an acquittal. It's actually very unusual if you look around the country. Other places tend to remove those from and don't allow public access to them.
So why is this an important time to be exploring this issue, especially in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we looked at this issue really from a workforce angle because we've done a lot of past research on barriers to employment and had seen in looking at Milwaukee County participants of workforce programs that a large percentage of them have criminal records. It was 42% of the 8 or 9,000 individuals we looked at in Milwaukee County. So it's a very big issue among unemployed people. And at a time when unemployment is so low, it's down to around 3%. We're looking for ways to reduce barriers that exist.
Is there any way to figure out exactly how many people are disqualified from jobs because of a criminal record?
I can't quite go that far. Like I said, there is 1.4 million people in Wisconsin that are estimated to have a criminal record. And when I saw the 42% in the Milwaukee County job seeker pool, that was a lot higher than I expected. Certainly a very common issue statewide.
So while you can't draw a direct correlation, it stands to figure that some percentage of these people who are unemployed and who have a criminal record are unemployed because they have a criminal record.
Right. And Wisconsin does have non-discrimination laws. And, so there are things in place to prevent people from being discriminated against. However, it still tends to be a barrier to getting a job.
Well, and you mentioned that there are people in the system who, you know, are there because of but had their charges dismissed or are acquitted. Are there people who are not employable just because they're in the system in general?
For a non-conviction?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think that a lot of this stuff is hard to know. It's just, you know, individual employers going online, checking the WCCA website, which is the website that lists all of the conviction records and non-conviction records. So really, it's hard to know exactly what factors are at play when they're making their decisions.
You mentioned that Wisconsin's expungement law is somewhat unusual at a national scale. So what are the ways that it differs from elsewhere? How do these laws work in other states compared to here?
Yeah, and that was a key part of our study, was really comparing us to other states. And we found one unusual thing in Wisconsin is that the decision is made by the judge at the sentencing hearing, and that's when it has to be made. It's the only time it can be made.
They decide whether a case could be expunged?
Exactly. They say, okay, this case, if you complete your sentence successfully, it will be expunged. That's when the decision is made, or they may decide you're not eligible. But you can't come back later after you've completed your sentence and say, you know, I've completed my sentence, I'm ready to move on, and can I clear this? That's not something that is possible currently. Whereas in most states, in fact, all other states, as far as we can tell, it happens after the fact, after the person has completed their sentence.
Other ways that the law differs from other states?
Yeah, other ways are Wisconsin imposes an age restriction. So the crime had to have been committed when the person was under the age of 25. So that's pretty unusual nationally as well. There are a few other states that have age restrictions, but generally it doesn't matter how old you were at the time. Another factor is the non-convictions, which we talked about. And one more is the severity of cases. So in Wisconsin, and as I said, you can have some very low-level nonviolent felonies expunged. In other states, in some other states, they're more broadly allowing felonies to be expunged of most types.
Now, when you started this work, you were initially looking at expungement as it pertains to Milwaukee County, correct?
Yeah, because like I said, it came out of our past research on barriers to employment here in Milwaukee. But as we looked into this issue and found that really the state law is what controls most of how this works in the state and in Milwaukee, we expanded it to really have a statewide focus. We did still look at data on Milwaukee County cases, Milwaukee being the largest county and having the most criminal records. We still felt that was relevant, but in terms of where possible changes could be considered, they'd mostly be at the state level.
So given how stringent Wisconsin's expungement law is, how often are cases being expunged in the states?
Well, we didn't specifically look into expungements that had occurred, but other research has done that. The Badger Institute, another research organization, has found that around 100 cases per year are expunged in Milwaukee County and around 2,000 statewide per year.
Well, and so presumably as you looked into how the existing law is applied, you looked at, you know, changes to the existing law. What sorts of changes did you explore, and what would be the upshot of those changes?
Yeah, so one thing we looked at was what if Wisconsin allowed judges to make the decisions after sentences were completed? Now, we can't really say that would change the number of cases necessarily, but going forward, an individual could come after completing their sentence and petition for expungement, and then the decision would be made then, as it is in every other state. The advantage of that, judges often feel that they can't really make that decision at sentencing. It's sort of like looking into a crystal ball. We heard that a lot in interviews we did. You know, it's just hard to make that call before the person has gone through their sentence. So that's one change. Another change would be to not only have the decision be made afterwards, but allow people to go back and request expungement of past cases that have been closed. So that would actually be a really large change that would potentially increase the number of eligible cases dramatically by thousands of cases.
That would add some significant administrative cost as well.
Right, and we looked at that. That's definitely a caution in the report, or something that would be a challenge, is that if there's a huge influx of new cases, it could have a lot of, you know, workload and fiscal impacts on local governments. But it partly depends on how the law would be structured. It could be that a lot of these cases could be decided without having to have hearings. So if that's the case, then it could have less impact on the courts.
Well, so in general, is there still some concern about what expungement would do in terms of allowing access to criminal records when criminal records might be relevant?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a balance there where the public wants access to be able to see whether somebody has committed a crime in the past, and but then on the other hand, there's the privacy of the ex-offender and the ability for them to be able to move on at some point from that conviction. So that's really where there is a balance between different interests and goals.
But presumably that's where the discretion of the judicial system would come in.
Potentially, yes. That's part of the issue in Wisconsin. There is a lot of discretion, and that is a positive in terms of allowing flexibility, allowing judges to make decisions based on the complexity of an individual case. But it also leads to a lot of disparities, perhaps, in how it's applied and lack of consistency across the state.
Joe Pietrangelo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can go to our website to find a link to the forum's report called A Fresh Start, Wisconsin's Atypical Expungement Law and Options for Reform. We first spoke with him in June.
After a short break, we'll consider another aspect of the incarceration dynamic, collateral consequences. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Right now, there are more than 2 million people incarcerated in the U.S., but that is just a small fraction of people with a criminal record.
More than 75 million people living here have been convicted of some kind of crime, most of whom spend the majority of their lives in free society. But just because they served their sentences doesn't mean they're free from consequences associated with that conviction.
Jack Chin is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis, and an expert on criminal law. He explains what collateral consequences are and how they impact people convicted of crimes.
Collateral consequences are the legal effects of a criminal conviction other than the traditional forms of punishment. So everybody's familiar, of course, with the fact that if you're convicted of a crime, you might have to go to jail, you might have to go to prison, you might have to pay a fine, you might have to be on probation or parole. But on top of that, there are a bunch of other things that can happen to you. You can lose the right to vote. You can lose the right to serve on a jury. You can be deported. And depending on the crime, you can lose lots of other rights and privileges, such as the ability to possess a firearm, the ability to drive a car. You can lose public benefits. And one of the most significant things that happens to a lot of people is that they lose their right, they lose their job, or they lose their right to have a license or a permit that they need to be employed or be in business.
So who is generally responsible for these consequences? Are they local? Are they statewide or federal?
All of the above. So some of the most important consequences are imposed by the federal government on state convictions. For example, the federal government passed a law some years ago that said that essentially, all the states have to deprive people of driver's licenses if they've been convicted of a drug offense. And the federal government created an opportunity to opt out of that. But the federal government said, states, you have to do this or you're going to lose some federal funding. So that's one source. There's a number of collateral consequences imposed by the federal government. The federal government also makes it a crime to possess a firearm if you've been convicted of a federal or a state offense. The states also have a bunch of collateral consequences that they impose on their own, such as jury service and the right to vote, but also counties, cities, and agencies. So a lot of regulatory boards will say that you can't have a barber's license, you can't have a cosmetology license, you can't be an accountant. And these are not created by state law or federal law. They're created by an agency acting on its own. So they're really proliferating because so many levels of government and branches of government can create these collateral consequences.
So when people are convicted of a crime or when they're in a jury, are juries made aware of these consequences outside of the actual criminal conviction?
Generally, they're not. And for the most part, the Supreme Court and other courts have said that there is no duty on the part of either the judge or the defense attorney to advise the individual of the collateral consequences that might apply. Now, there is an exception. In 2010, in a case called Padilla versus Kentucky, the U.S. Supreme Court said that if the client in a criminal case is a non-citizen and they might be deported if they plead guilty or are convicted of the crime, then the defense attorney has to tell them that. But other things, for the most part, are, you know, some people call it the secret sentence or invisible punishment, because nobody has to tell the individual that this might happen. The jury doesn't necessarily know. The judge doesn't necessarily know. The lawyers don't necessarily know. And so these things a lot of times are surprises. To give you an example, in 2016, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that there was no obligation to tell somebody pleading guilty or being convicted of a sex offense that after they serve whatever time is imposed, whatever prison time is imposed, they might be subject to civil commitment afterwards. This seems to be pretty important, right? If you're getting, let's imagine you're getting probation for a sex offense, the fact that you actually might be confined against your will, that would seem to be a pretty important consideration in deciding whether to go forward with that plea bargain or not, or how to handle that case. You know, do you mortgage your house to hire a lawyer or not? You know, how serious a problem is this? But the Supreme Court in this state said that it wasn't necessary for somebody to know that that was going to happen. So a lot of times people are surprised that they lose a vested public pension, for example, based on a particular criminal conviction, or they have to register as a sex offender or as some other sort of criminal offender.
Well, it seems problematic not just from the view of those who are convicted, but also of those who are convicting them, juries who don't really know what they're sentencing someone to. So when we look at Wisconsin specifically, what are some of the more kind of hidden sanctions that Wisconsin has?
Well, I will say that Wisconsin, of all the states, is one of the better states. And the reason for that is that your former public defender, Mike Tobin, his office put together some collections of major collateral consequences that apply based on convictions in this state. And so for the last 5 to 10 years, there has been better information available in Wisconsin than in most other states that defense lawyers can if they choose, or probation officers can if they choose, judges can if they choose, use to inform people of what the real situation is. But, you know, typically among the things that happens, ineligibility for public benefits is a significant one for drug offenses and other sorts of offenses. You might get kicked out of public housing. And a lot of times this applies not just if the leaseholder is convicted of a drug offense, but if anyone in the unit is convicted of a drug offense. So the whole family can lose their housing based on an offense by one member. And so that's pretty significant. The occupational disqualifications, many professions have a restriction on people with convictions, you know, holding a license as an attorney, as a doctor, that sort of thing. And in some instances, that will make perfect sense. In some instances, a criminal conviction really will be associated with a danger to customers, patients, clients, et cetera. But it's not clear to me why a conviction for income tax evasion, for example, means somebody can't go hunting. I don't see the connection. But the law says that if you have a felony conviction, then you can't possess a firearm, that sort of thing. The American Bar Association pursuant to a contract from the federal government, put together a collection of collateral consequences in all the states. And it looks like there's something like 40, 50,000 collateral consequences in statutes and regulations. You know, so something like 800 to 1,000 in every state, mostly dealing with occupational disqualification, mostly dealing with jobs that a person can't have if they have a particular felony conviction.
In Wisconsin, we've had a little bit of pushback to some of these collateral consequences, specifically the occupancy rules on sex offenders. So I believe it was Pleasant Prairie, where a group of sex offenders sued the city in order to have a little bit more leeway in where they were allowed to live.
Right.
And we're seeing that now throughout the state, to the point that a lot of cities are trying to kind of preempt the lawsuit by removing some of these regulations. Are we seeing similar pushback to any other collateral consequences in Wisconsin or throughout the country?
I think there is a recognition that there are costs to imposing too many collateral consequences. We want to protect the public. We want to protect public safety. But we have tens of millions of people with criminal record out there. There's something like 2 million people in prison, but 75 million people, adult Americans, with a criminal record. And if they can't work, if they can't make a living in the legitimate economy, that's a big problem for us. Because many of them, if they can't make an honest living, will make a dishonest living. And there's a cost to society when somebody who could have been reformed, when somebody who could have contributed to society and lived a law-abiding life, instead recidivates and returns to crime. So one of the things that's happening in a lot of places around the country is something called ban the box. And ban the box means that in at least the initial application, in at least the initial part of a process for public employment or sometimes employment in general, the job application is not going to ask about criminal record unless there's an absolute bar. So let's say it's a law enforcement job and a felony conviction is an absolute bar. In that case, they might ask at the initial stage. But they'll wait until the person has a job offer. And at that point, they'll ask about the criminal record. And then in the context of the total person, in the context of all of the information that the employer has about the applicant whom they now want to hire, then they'll say, okay, does this criminal record change things? Or is it so far in the past and so contradicted by evidence of good behavior in the years since that criminal conviction that we're going to go ahead and hire this person? So that's something that's happened in a lot of cities and states around the country. And the view is that this gives people with criminal records a chance to make a living without unduly impairing public safety. Another thing that's happened is that there are a number of states in recent years have added methods to have a criminal record sealed, expunged, or overcome by a certificate of rehabilitation or a certificate of good conduct. And the idea is that once somebody has paid their debt to society and once somebody has demonstrated by good behavior over a period of years, there should be a way for the judge that sentenced them or for a parole board or somebody else to take a look at their record and say, we're ready to let you move on. If somebody has done what they're supposed to do, they've made a mistake in the past, you know, the evidence indicates that criminal behavior declines with age. And so older people are less likely to commit crimes than younger people. And so if we have somebody who looks like they're headed in the right direction, they might be able, there are more and more states that are allowing them to have their records sealed, expunged, or in some other way, some indication that they're no longer the person they were and they should be treated like everybody else in society.
All right. Well, Jack Chin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Jack Chin is a law professor at UC Davis. This conversation originally aired in November while Chin was in Milwaukee for a lecture at Marquette University. He spoke with Joy Powers.
Coming up, writer David McGlynn's first memoir was of a dark, difficult time in his life. His newest work is also a memoir, but takes a lighter tone as he looks at the realities of fatherhood. We'll hear more from McGlynn when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Fatherhood is, at turns, challenging, rewarding, exasperating, and even fun. As the dad of two sons, writer David McGlynn has experienced all of these states of fatherhood.
He's grown used to being a dad at the same time that he's grown used to being a Wisconsinite. McGlynn grew up in Texas before going to California for college. He was living in Utah when he took a job teaching at Lawrence University in Appleton.
His new memoir, One Day You'll Thank Me, is a chronicle of his adjustment to parenting and to his adopted home state. It's sometimes absurd, sometimes touching, and almost always compelling. McGlynn was in Milwaukee in early June at Boswell Book Company, but he also joined us in the studio ahead of that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the subtitle of this book is Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. And while it sounds like the timing of becoming a dad might not have been ideal, was there ever any question about actually becoming a father for you?
You know, there really wasn't. I knew from a pretty early age. You know, that sounds a bit strange, but, you know, I knew growing up that I was going to one day have a family, right? I think that was just a part of my way of thinking about myself. Given that my parents had divorced when I was 12, the question of what it means to have a family and the desires to be with a parent and children and whatnot were very much a part of my thinking as a teenager and as a young adult. I was not ready, though, for having kids when I had them. Both of them caught us off guard.
Well, and it's interesting because you said, you know, you knew from a fairly early age that you wanted to have a family. And that's kind of maybe an underrated part of the male growing up experience. The stereotype is that girls are thinking about this stuff far before boys
are. That's right.
Are.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I mean, for me, especially in my story, you know, having my parents split and my dad move away so quickly and so far away left me from a very early age, from the time I was 12, longing to be with my dad. And at a certain point, that just flips itself around where you think, you know, rather than longing to be with the dad, you start to think that one day I'll want to have children and this relationship will replicate itself. And, you know, the things that didn't get to happen when I was a kid will somehow be idealized by having children and being a dad. So that's how I've always kind of thought about having kids.
Is it oversimplifying things to talk about, you know, righting some wrongs or what might have in your mind have been wrongs?
Well, you know, not so much righting wrongs, but getting the chance to sort of have those experiences and have that kind of time and presence and consistency that I hadn't always gotten to have with my own dad.
Even so, you're right that you still were able to kind of maintain a pretty strong relationship as you could with your dad.
Well, that was the thing I was just going to say is that, you know, despite the distance between us, he and I have had, from the very beginning, a really close and intense relationship. And that was one of the best things of my growing up. You know, when we would spend time together, it was always really positive and also very intense and very connected time. I felt like I learned a lot from him, even though I had to learn those things in a compressed amount of time.
And sometimes over the phone next to a Dr. Pepper machine.
Oftentimes over the phone, you know. And in many ways, like the Dr. Pepper machine and the payphone is the kind of setup for the story, you know, that these lessons that I learned from my dad, I learned piecemeal. And I learned them through talking to him a few minutes at a time, a couple times a week. And so when I went to sort of think about how this book was going to get set up, I had that in the back of my mind, you know, these moments that you pay attention to yourself as a father or as a parent. And they started to seem like these sort of payphone conversations I was having with myself. And so that became the form that I used.
This is not your first memoir. Had you been kind of keeping track of life as a parent since it began?
So it's not my first memoir. It's my third book total. It's my second memoir. The previous memoir is A Door in the Ocean, and it came out in 2012. And that is in some ways a strange predecessor to this one because the story that one tells is far darker, and it's concerned with the loss of a close friend when I was in high school. When that book finished and I was coming out of it and looking for a new project, I started to think about, okay, what things are available to me right around my everyday and what things might be a break from this really heavy and violent story. And that was when I realized that I had these moments that I could draw out of fatherhood. And I really just started with one, and that one was the chapter in the book that's now called Heirlooms. It was published in Men's Health magazine under the title My Dad, Bad Santa. And it's about my father's really bad Christmas presents. You know, and if you can indulge it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you need to paint a picture of what some of these gifts are.
And, you know, people talk about their parents like not being good gift givers. You know, mine was bad in a whole other way, you know. For example, we would get every year like a sleeve of spaghetti and a jar of tomato sauce, or I'd get a cheese sampler. And one year he gave me a big sausage. I was always getting food. You know, I think that he and my stepmom were always sort of aghast at how much I was eating.
Change from his ashtray.
Well, and the worst that it ever was he dumped his pickup truck's ashtray into a Ziploc baggie and wrapped it up and put it under the tree. And it was $17 and some number of cents that I unwrapped, you know, sitting by the tree with a cup of coffee on Saturday morning. And the funny thing about those presents is that they were always a kind of gag between us. And at the same time, there was always something kind of emotional about them. You know, I always thought, oh, no, Christmas is going to really be a disappointment. However, the real thing with Christmas was that I didn't really want the presents in the first place. I just wanted more time. I just wanted to spend time with him, time by the ocean, which is where he lived, time just sort of hanging around. And in some ways, those presents seemed to understand that and kind of make fun of it all at the same time. And it struck me as I was sort of telling this funny story, which I just imagined as something funny, that the gift of time and presence is something I still long for with him, but it's also the thing that I can give to my own children, not only every Christmas, but in many ways every day.
It's funny because it seems like one of those cliches that you always read about that, you know, the best gift that you can give your kids is time and presence. And in the case of this cliche, it really is true.
You know, it's as much as it is a cliche, it seems as though there's really no way around it. You know, the things that we get for birthdays and Christmases and big holidays and whatever are ultimately just material things that pass away. I think the same could probably be said with the ways in which we approach parenting in terms of thinking about advice that we dispense. You know, here's the thing you need to know about this. Here's the thing you need to know about that. Here's how you tie a tie, and here's how you start the lawnmower, and here's how you, you know, ask someone out on a date or something like that. What really ends up mattering, I think, is just that we're around each other. We spend time in each other's presence. We create spaces as parents and children, as fathers to sons, to have intimate and honest conversations. And so presence ultimately is the best possible present.
Let's get back for a second to that word unexpected.
Yeah.
What do you see as maybe the most unexpected or among the most unexpected aspects to fatherhood as you've experienced it?
That's a really great question. You know, I guess I would say I've always imagined myself as a kind of person of principle. You know, I think a lot. I think through my writing. I'd always thought that when I, you know, became a father, I would have these commitments and these ideals that I would somehow try to live by. And here are the things that I'm really connected to, you know, as a family, as a person, as a parent, as a whatever. And children seem like they are born knowing how to thwart your principles, your ideals, and your best intentions. They are endlessly moving targets. And that means that in most situations, and in many ways the book is sort of telling these stories again and again, we're presented with some kind of challenge. I think that I have a principle that's going to lead me through, and it never quite goes the right way the first time around. And I find myself having to back up, rethink it, and sort of, you know, change course in response to how the kids are trying to thwart my own expectations or my own good efforts or sort of get around whatever, you know, thing I've sort of put before them.
We should note that there is, in fact, a kid in the studio with us.
He's sitting right here beside me.
And he has not thwarted any part of this interview yet.
He's inching ever closer, though. He's about to speak into the microphone.
So I wonder if you have any concerns that a book like this puts your readers in the position of judging your parenting skills and your wife's parenting skills.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I have real concerns about how they're going to judge us. You know, one of the ways that a book like this works is that you just throw yourself out there and say, you know, and this is in some ways the conceit, you know, for everything that I was confronted with, I screwed it up the first time. And it turned out to be okay. By seeing the failure the first time around, I'm able to go back and learn it in a different way. And I'm sure that there are things that I do as a dad, whether intentionally or inadvertently, that people are going to really disagree with. And that's okay. You know, I think that it's more important to understand that most of us are trying to make it up as we go along. And there's probably the most joy and the most unexpected delight, as well as the unexpected moments of meaning and closeness and intimacy that happen when you have to improvise, you know. And I would guess that most parents are great improvisers.
Yeah, I try not to invoke books by other authors during interviews with authors, but there's a book just coming out by the writer Pamela Druckerman that is sitting on my to-be-read stack next to my bed, but it's called There Are No Grown-Ups. And I think part of the point it makes is that for most of us, adulthood is this kind of learn-as-you-go proposition.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that book, but I do think that that's a very true statement. You know, most of us are trying to do the best that we can. One of the things that interested me as I was sort of working on One Day You'll Thank Me is the way that American men or American fathers get portrayed in pop culture and in the media. You know, and if you think about it, especially think about the TV shows that feature dads as a sort of prominent part of the show, you often have the sort of heavy-handed, heavy-fisted, dictatorial father. And on the other hand, you have the sort of Phil Dunphy character. And I'm a great fan of Modern Family, but he in some ways is emblematic of that other side. You know, he's the constant playmate. He's kind of adult. You know, he's often sort of cruising for a kind of comeuppance or something, you know. And my experience talking to friends, talking to people, you know, sort of just in the course of life, tells me that most American fathers of whatever persuasion are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. You know, few of any of us see ourselves as absolute sort of heavy-fisted dictators. And yet most of us see ourselves as taking the job seriously. You want to do right by your kids. And that means that, you know, when confronted with challenges, problems, whether they're funny or they become more serious, you don't want to just sort of wave it off or dismiss it. You don't want to overreact and you don't want to underreact. You're looking for that sort of Goldilocks happy medium. And I was trying to show that the mistakes lead you to that kind of you know, backwards wisdom, I guess.
It is a model of fatherhood that doesn't lend itself very well to the Father's Day cards you see at Walgreens.
Absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. And I didn't want it to be any kind of self-help book. You know, the other thing that you see with Father's Day books or father's books are survival guides, you know, the sort of sergeant's guide to surviving the first year of fatherhood or something. And again, I think that most parents don't just want to survive it. They want to thrive. They want to have a relationship with their children that is meaningful and rich and fun and funny and also sort of shows them the world for all of its complex beauty.
Well, David McGlynn, thank you so much.
What a
great book and a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
David McGlynn's new memoir is called One Day You'll Thank Me. McGlynn, who's an associate professor and chair of the English department at Lawrence University in Appleton, is also the author of the previous memoir, A Door in the Ocean. We spoke with him in June.
Coming up next, our film contributor considers what makes French films distinctive. We'll speak with him in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Even without hearing the language, you can often tell a French film by its sensibilities, intelligence, maybe a touch of irony, its use of light. And then, of course, there is the language.
Milwaukee's annual tribute to French culture is the Bastille Days celebration. The 37th rendition of the festival runs this Thursday through Sunday. Most of the festival's offerings, food, wine, music, and more, are at Cathedral Square Park. But this year, there's one activity you won't experience at Cathedral Square.
Tomorrow, the Avalon Theater in Bayview teams up with the East Town Association to present a screening of the 2001 film Amelie, a film that audiences love just as much today as they did when it came out.
Our film contributor, Dave Lurson, admits he first gave the movie a harsh review 17 years ago, but he's come around to it since then. He recently joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to discuss not just Amelie, but others from France as well.
French film is a vast subject, and it covers virtually every genre, except, I think, really superhero movies, which are just
true.
Extremely expensive, and America has the lock on that, the patent on it anyway. There are good, bad, and mediocre French films, and every shade in between. I think that there is a tendency toward intelligence, that French films tend to be, you know, a bit smarter maybe than, in some way, than many Hollywood films. Also, certainly before the mid-1960s, French films and the films of many European countries were much more sexually frank than Hollywood films were. They tended to delve into issues a little more deeply than Hollywood because Hollywood operated under a very rigid self-censorship code, and the French film industry was much looser in what it could do.
I also think that compared to perhaps the standard American escapism when it came to movies, even in the 1950s and 60s, French films often have that element of self-reflection, whether it's the character or making the audience think.
Well, when a film is an escapist film, and maybe Amelie is in some way, I think it's aware of itself as an escapist film. It's making a comment in a way. Maybe the French were way ahead of Americans with irony and appreciating that.
Yeah, I also think, especially with Amelie that we'll be talking about, there's a charm and whimsy full in this movie.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to admit that when I reviewed the movie when it was released in 2001, I gave it a scathingly negative review. And when the DVD came out later that year or next year, I reluctantly watched it and I changed my mind completely. And I think I was guilty of doing something that many critics do at some point or other. And I try not to do it, but I fell prey. Jean-Pierre Genet, the director, had done some much darker movies prior to that time. And I was expecting dark. And I get Amelie. And I think I was just kind of disappointed and flabbergasted, and it didn't meet my preconceptions, but I'm happy it didn't. He set out to make what he called a positive story instead of the kinds of things that he normally had been working on. The movie Amelie looks a lot like his previous films in terms of being very visually overloaded intentionally. But according to him, the movie Amelie is kind of an emotional autobiography of moving to Paris in the 1970s for him and experiencing the city. I'm not quite sure where he came from, somewhere in provincial France, but he had the same kind of sense of wonder and awe that many people have when going there. And some of the stories in the film were collected from people he met or people he knew. So he assembled this kind of fascinating patchwork together about life in Paris at some indeterminate time in human history.
Yeah, it almost hops between time and generations, because at one point you could think that you're watching the French equivalent of Roman Holiday, but then you see a photocopier somewhere.
Yeah, it intentionally destroys the sense of chronology. I could term it retro. I mean, it's kind of retro for the most part in appearance, but not quite. It's sort of mid-20th century, but not exactly. It really is evoking a Paris of the imagination, a Paris more beautiful and wonderful than any Paris at any time could possibly have been. And I think that the director succeeded very well in achieving that.
Yeah, it's slick, it's fast, it's quirky. It's a feel-good fantasy that follows a woman who is overall a very introverted person due to her upbringing, who it's suddenly her life's work to make everyone happy through various plots and schemes.
Yes, and I think she's made film audiences around the world very happy.
So do you recall any specific criticisms or words you had when you first reviewed this movie?
I thought there was an excess of whimsy, and maybe sometimes I'm a little skeptical of whimsy when it goes too far. My appetite for it isn't as great as it should be, maybe. So I think that was my main criticism of it. Was just, but, you know, this is intelligent whimsy. It was whimsy well thought out, well visualized, well put together, well enacted, and fine. I mean, maybe if I would have to make the five greatest whimsical movies of all time, this and maybe, I don't know, The Wizard of Oz.
Right. Before we get to some of the other French films, I'm curious, did this style of filmmaking, or did the standard start with the French New Wave cinema? You had a big amount of pictures released between 1958 and 1963. We had 170 French filmmakers directed their first feature. So that's definitely a flood of movies in a short period of time.
Well, the French New Wave movement is interesting because it got underway during the 50s and was launched by and large by film critics who decided that, first of all, they worked out a kind of aesthetic or ideology of filmmaking, and it's not good enough just to write about this. Let's do it ourselves. They were able to do it themselves because of advances in technology allowing for more portable cameras, lighting equipment that you could move around more. And then there was the sensibility, too, of catching the real environment in which things would take place, even though many of these movies definitely try to deconstruct or subvert the normal sense of realism that you would get in watching a movie.
One of those films, Breathless, is almost a quintessential example of a new wave crime drama written and directed by Jean-Luc Godard. So what kind of ideas and innovations did Godard bring to the film industry?
Well, the opening credit dedicated to Monogram Pictures. What's Monogram Pictures? A very low-budget, third-rate edge of Hollywood studio back in the 1940s and so on. He was, you know, again, in a loving and ironic way, you know, tipping his hat to Pulp Fiction. Things that might be considered trashy in some way. So this movie was a commentary on American crime drama and film noir, respectful but yet disrespectful. The major character in the film, Michel, is kind of a preposterous caricature of a tough guy in many ways. The female character in the movie is treated, I think, with greater depth than you would have found in American movies of that type from the era. And the editing of it is very ragged looking at times, maybe intentionally, maybe not. There is a sense of the reality of real environments on the streets of Paris, and yet things that just are too fantastic that are occurring there that you wouldn't find occurring there in real life. It's just this strange collision of heightened realism and a sense of the fantasy world of Hollywood somehow coming together in a Paris setting.
What ideas or thoughts did you revisit as you watched this again after, you know, you and I have talked about obviously more recent movies, but to take the time to sit down and watch this movie again?
Well, I think I understood the irony of it much better. I saw it for the first time on the big screen somewhere. I think it may have been when I was running the Film Society at UWM. I may have just booked it because I knew it was a classic film, and that may have been where I saw it for the first time, and I was very young, and I was just kind of, oh. I hadn't seen as many of the films that influenced Godard by that point. I think maybe that's where my different perspective comes in. Now that I've seen many of the things that influenced him, I understand better where he was coming from. And also in recent years, or last couple of decades, I can see the way that Breathless has influenced Quentin Tarantino and maybe a whole generation of American so-called indie directors for the sense of, again, the ironic take on Hollywood movie conventions, the mobility of the film, you know, catching something very much on the fly, being able to do it at a very low budget. All of these things, I think, had a delayed impact on American filmmakers.
One film that our listeners may be the most familiar with regarding French film is The Artist, which, you know, at the time would have been an unlikely winner of Best Picture, Best Director, in 2011 for a black and white silent film.
The first silent film to win an Oscar since the very first Oscar Awards in 1927.
Yeah.
This film is a whole bunch of footnotes in cinema history, really. It was not the only black and white silent film produced in the world around that period of time. For some reason, there was a little ripple of these kinds of movies from different countries. I'm not quite sure what the zeitgeist was that resulted in that, but this movie, in its own way, is also a look at Hollywood from distant eyes. The story takes place in Hollywood in the late 1920s and early 30s, during the time of, you know, many people are familiar with Singing in the Rain, the time of transition from silent to sound, in which many stars couldn't make the transition because their voices sounded funny, or because in some cases the Hollywood studios wanted to clean house and get rid of troublesome people. So, we don't like the way you sound on your sound check, so we're going to get rid of you and relieve you of your contract. So, yeah, this movie, unlikely, you know, an outlier really in filmmaking in so many ways. It won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, first French actor ever to win in that category. So it swept the imagination of the Academy of Motion Pictures during that year and tantalized a great many people worldwide.
Yeah, I remember seeing it at the Downer, and that was the perfect setting for a silent black and white film. You know, it's like you were transported. I imagine the experience would have been different, say, had I gone to a Cineplex place. But
yeah, Downer, Oriental, or Avalon, I think if you were going to pick a place to see a movie like this, those would be the venues you'd hope to find it in, because it transports you so entirely into the kind of environment where this sort of filmmaking was greened at the time.
Audiences in Milwaukee will be able to see Amelie on the big screen rather than, you know, streaming on Netflix. What's the case that you would make for someone to go see this in that form, whether they've, you know, it's been a few years since they've seen it since its release, or if they've never seen it before?
Well, it's at the Avalon Theater, so you're getting a beautiful retro environment for it, getting back to that point. But also the film is so visually rich that sitting back, relaxing in a chair and seeing it on a gigantic screen allows you to really pick out and appreciate some of the work that went into furnishing the scenes. The whole milieu of it is just so well put together that watching it at home on a smaller screen, I think that you may miss quite a few things.
Well, Dave, thanks for coming in to talk about French films. I feel like I wish I had a college course in it.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express, and he is one of our regular film contributors. He talked with Audrey Nowakowski about the 2001 film Amelie, which is showing tomorrow at the Avalon Theater in Bayview in conjunction with this weekend's Bastille Day celebration. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.